Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
So you know how I'm always droning on each week about how you can go to indieauthoranswers.com and read along with the text of the show, the text of The Problematic Virtue that I read a chunk of every week, so you don't have to just listen to me read it. You can actually see the text in a visual media format. Well, I did a little bit of research and I figured out that most people who listen to this show do so on iOS devices, iPhones, iPods, iPads, and are also using Apple's podcasting app. Does it freak you out to know how much Big Brother knows about you? I don't know. Probably not. It's not a big deal, right? Anyway, so I did a bit of testing. And so the fact that you can read along at Indie Author Answers might not do you a whole lot of good if you're not listening to the show each week as it comes out. If you're, you know, burning through them, it might be kind of hard to find all the text. So anyway, I was doing some research, and on the podcasting app that you get from Apple, the built-in one that comes with iOS, it shows you the first X characters from the blog post at indieauthoranswers.com where the podcast comes from. So you can read along with the first bit of text. Now, as of the recording of this date, January whatever, 2016, Happy New Year, by the way, if you use an app like Downcast, Downcast, which you can get on iOS, that shows you the whole text of the chapter that we read each week. I'm not sure, and Downcast isn't the sponsor of the show or anything, it's the app I use for podcasts and I really like it. If you listen to the show on that app, you would be able to read along with the whole text from your phone as you're listening. Now, you could always just go to indieauthoranswers.com on your phone and read along, because you would see the whole text there. But if you're listening to this in the future, first of all, I'd like to welcome our alien overlords and thank you for listening to my show. But that might be the easiest way to get it. Anyway, as I said, this is a new year. It's early January 2016 as of the date this airs, and welcome to the new year. I hope everyone had good holiday season, good New Year's, was able to sleep off your hangovers on New Year's Day and didn't have to do something horrible like going to work or anything like that. And I hope everyone is making good progress on those New Year's goals. I know all of you probably just signed up for a brand new gym membership, so which you will go steadfastly for about a month and then slowly fade away and then not go at all anymore. At least that's what I used to do. I'm just kidding. I know that everyone who listens to this show has that kind of personal fortitude and perseverance that you're going to stick to your goals. But I thought maybe we might talk this week a little bit about goal setting. I'm sure I've mentioned this before. I use an app on my phone called Goal Streaks. In fact, I know I've mentioned it before. Where I give myself an X for each day that I accomplish a specific goal, and I track a number of different goals with the app, but writing every day is one of my goals, and I recently crossed 1,000 days of writing in a row, 1,000 days in a row of writing. And, well, not necessarily writing, but it's just 1,000 days in a row of doing something for my author business. On some of those days, I might not write. Some of those days, I might prepare a newsletter to go out to my mailing list, or I might work on a book cover, or I might be reviewing edits that my copy editor has sent back to me. You know, or writing a book description that may be going up, or uploading a book to KDP or to some other platform. There's a million things I could do for my author business that don't actually involve literal writing fiction. So one of my goals for 2016 is going to be to keep that streak going, to be able at the end of the year say that every day I did something for my author business. And lately, the last year or so, that's been, well, not the last year, the last few months, that's been a real incredible challenge in my life, because probably a lot of you longtime listeners to the show know that for a good chunk of 2015, I didn't have a day job. I was just writing, and I was doing some freelance work here and there. But I was able to set my own schedule, and then in September of this year, I got a new day job, and it was just, it was a great opportunity, and I couldn't pass it up. But now the fact is I have a commute every day, and I go into an office, you know, that's the 15 miles down the road. And so my time is not as free to structure as I want. And the moral of that story is that I just have a lot less time than I used to. And I know I was complaining about this on an episode a few weeks ago about how busy I was, and I was a dick. And I think I apologized for being a dick in the next episode. But, you know, I have a wife and I have a young child, and they also require attention. So the being able to find time in the day to write is very, very challenging. And so one of the things that I've done, one of my goals for 2016, is that I've set a release schedule. And I'm not going to tell you exactly what's on it, but in 2015, I didn't have a release schedule. In 2015, my main goal in my author business was to get as much quality content out there for sale as possible. Because at the beginning of 2015, you know, on January 1, 2015, I think I had maybe one or two things on Amazon for sale, and they were both short stories. And now I have several full-length novels and a couple of short story collections. So I have enough product out there that I have a catalog. So I can slow down a little bit in 2015. Well, not can slow down. I have to slow down because of my reduced amount of time I have for writing. But so I am able now, my goal is to get very focused about my release schedule, my release dates, and my smaller deadlines. You know, in through most of 2015, I could sit down and I would have a 4 or 5 hour stretch where I was home alone and I could write, you know, 7,000-8,000 words over that 4 or 5 hours. But if I only wrote 4 or 5,000 words because I spent an hour of that time dicking around on Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus, it wasn't a big deal. But now that is a huge deal if I've wasted an hour of precious writing time doing social media izing. So I've had to learn very quickly how to maximize and be more efficient in my writing time, because I may only get 30 minutes in the morning by getting up a little early. I may get 30, 45 minutes during my lunch break at work, and then I may get 30 or 45 minutes at night to, you know, after I put my young son to sleep. It always sounds strange to say that. You know, people say put him to sleep or put him down. It's just, as a fiction writer, when I hear those things, I think that I'm murdering him. But trust me, I've not murdered my young son. Anyway, I'll stop talking about that because that's kind of creepy. But so if you add up those three sections, you know, across the day, that's maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours that I get to focus on my author business. And so I need to know, I have a very structured process now for how I go from beginning a book, to, you know, to having no words on the page, to being able to hit the publish button on Amazon and whatever other platforms I publish to. I'm also having to keep very strict lists. I use an internet app called Trello, T-R-E-L-L-O, and I'm pretty sure I've talked about this before. I use Trello to track as a project manager. It's good for, you can basically just create lists that are columns and you drag items. It's kind of a developer scrum method. Not scrum. What's the word? Kanban? I can't remember what I used to call it when I worked in software. Anyway, so it's basically a project management tracking tool. So I see where I am. Like I list, okay, for this book, here are all the things I have to do. I have to work with a cover designer to get the cover. I need to write a blog post announcing the book. I need to write an email to my mailing list announcing the book. I need to create the book on Goodreads. I need to schedule it for pre-orders. I need to seek out advanced readers for reviews. All those kind of things. I list out each of those things every time I have a book coming out. And so I know where I am with each of those goals. Whereas, you know, before, maybe early in 2015, I could kind of do those things at my leisure. And for me, probably like most of you, leisure is a luxury that we can no longer afford, or I can no longer afford. So that is all I wanted to say about goals for 2016. I'm not going to actually lay out my goals because why would you? I don't know why you'd care. But you're listening to the show because you want to become a better writer and become better at self-publishing. And so if I could give one piece of advice, it would be set yourself a schedule and stick to it. Set deadlines that are realistic but make you stretch a bit. Because if you give yourself – there's an old saying in the software industry that if you give a developer 2 weeks to complete a project, he'll complete it in 2 weeks. If you give him 10 days to complete a project, he'll complete it in 10 days. That the amount of work, the amount of time you have will be filled by the amount of work you have, no matter what the time is. Does that make sense? Like, so if you set deadlines that are a little bit tight, you'll stretch to reach those. You'll find ways to become more efficient. Or you'll blow right past those deadlines and then beat yourself up, which you shouldn't do that either. All right, cool beans. So I think we can stop talking about that. And now we're going to get back into reading a section of The Problematic Virtue. Today we're going to read Part 4, Chapter 2. It's a Brian chapter. And if you remember, the last time we saw Brian was the final chapter in Part 3 when Brian was hanging out on campus and he got confirmation from his friend Graham that Megan was indeed married to Derek Wiles' brother Chris Wiles. And also, to add insult to injury, he also found out that his ex-girlfriend Heather, who he dated way back in part one of the book, and then they eventually broke up, he found out that she died of a cocaine overdose. So Brian is at a very low point when we first meet him in part four of the book. All right, let's do it. 2. Brian. He considered the activity a form of self-flagellation, but he did it anyway. Brian spent most of spring break working on a long-procrastinated project, taking his old photographs and converting them to digital versions via the scanner he had received as a Christmas present the year before. The inspiration came the day he learned about Heather, when he sat down to look through some old pictures. Brian could devote time to this task with no distractions, since Alex had been gone for several days and left Brian with free rein of the apartment. With multiple days of autonomy, Brian spent nearly all of his time at home, numbing his grief with beer and scanning pictures. 200 pictures so far completed, with a couple hundred more to go. He held a photograph of her, standing on her apartment balcony in the morning, wearing nothing but one of Brian's long shirts. A wry smile sat on her face and her hands cradled a cup of steaming coffee. Innocent but seductive at the same time, a look that Heather had executed well. Her pictures were the hardest to tolerate because he had none from the ugly and painful ending to their relationship. Scenes like the one of her wearing his t-shirt falsely emphasized the good times over the bad. He had no photos of her attempting to stop a nosebleed in the bathroom, arguing with him about something trivial, or having sex with his young, impressionable best friend. Without that kind of evidence, he could loiter in the euphoric recall. Brian's phone rang, and as he had done all week, he ignored it. The only number he might respond to would be Megan's, although he doubted if even then. That situation had not come up. The calls had been from Wiles, Miguel, Graham, Brian's parents, and some unknown numbers, and Brian had not wanted to talk to any of them. His mother left him a voicemail about a wild goose chase that she and his father had undertaken when a young man matching Jimmy's description turned up at an Idaho homeless shelter. As with his parents' other investigations, their efforts amounted to nothing, and he had not the energy to engage their fruitless hunt for their missing son. Brian accepted that Jimmy was not coming back. He did need to talk to Wiles because he wanted out. Brian just did not know how to broach that topic in a way that would make Wiles listen. The man had a way of forcing his will, as Brian was well aware, and Brian had a history of cowering to Wiles' influence. Brian thought it best to avoid him for now. Sooner or later, he'll just show up anyway, so I might as well let him come to me. Then a rustling at the door and a key turning in the lock. In walked Alex with a duffel bag over his shoulder. He looked pale and droopy-eyed, probably drunk. "What's up, Slim Shady? You look like shit," he said. Indeed, Brian looked terrible. He had not showered or shaved all week, and had been wearing the same clothes for 3 days. "Where have you been?" Brian said. You've been gone for almost a week. It's spring break, dude. I had some business to take care of out of town. No big deal, just had to go do some stuff. I was going to let you know, but then I thought you probably wouldn't care no matter what. The end. The electric is due tomorrow. Can you take care of that for me? Alex said as he pulled out a wad of bills and started counting. He peeled off a few 20s out of a roll that contained at least 30 or 40 bills. I need to go out of town again tomorrow morning, just for the day. He tossed the money carelessly, and the bills fluttered and landed on the couch cushions. Brian looked at the scattered pile of crisp $20 bills. His heartbeat quickened, his palms began to sweat, as he realized now for the first time all week, he would have to share about Heather and that would make it real. Alex, sit down. I need to talk to you. Alex dropped his duffel and fell onto the couch. He dug a hand underneath it, extracted a glass and a meager bag of pot. Down to the dregs, he said, pinching the small bag. Shake's better than nothing, though. He loaded weed into the bowl, then lit it. All right, let's hear it, he said as he exhaled a plume of thick, gray smoke. Brian sat down next to Alex on the couch. I need to tell you something, and it's not going to be easy, but... Before Brian could finish even the first sentence of his news, Alex yawned, picked up the remote control, and turned on the TV. Brian snatched the remote away from him and pressed the power button. Hey, dude, I was watching that. Brian's patience was already wearing thin. He had not even started. Damn it, Alex, this is important. It's about Heather. I don't know quite how to tell you this. Who? Heather, Brian said. Heather's gone. Alex hit the pipe again before asking, who? Heather Robson, my ex. She was drunk and overdosed on cocaine. She died in the bathroom of a bar in Denver. Hey, that's where I spent my 20th birthday. Back when I had my fake ID, I mean. They never ID'd me before, but after I got it taken away, they all of a sudden started carding me every time. Karma, right? Are you listening to me? Heather passed away. The service is tomorrow if you want to go. I think you should come with me. Alex yawned again. I don't think I'll make it. You have a good time, though. Unbelievable. This level of indifference was outrageous, even for Alex. What the hell is wrong with you? Heather, you remember my ex-girlfriend, the one that you fucked. Alex glared at Brian. I know, boo-hoo. That chick was on the self-destruct plan from day one. Tide comes in, tide goes out. It's just the cycle of life. You don't act surprised when the sun rises in the morning. You selfish piece of shit. Don't you even care that I'm upset? If you don't care about her, how about a little damn empathy from me, or is that too much to ask from you? Alex tapped out the cashed bowl in an ashtray and opened the bag to load another. Look, dude, I've been out of town, I just got home and I'm tired. I'd just kind of like to veg out here for a bit, smoke some bowls, and then go lay down. Brian wanted nothing more than to smack the little bastard upside his head, but he fought the urge. Not even that would dent Alex's armor. Instead, the only thing he could do was remove himself from the situation and leave Alex to his own devices. He had nothing left to say. Without another word, Brian returned to his room and slammed the door. Brian promptly sat down to write his letter to Alex. At first, the note came out as a bitter piece of accusatory nonsense, pure venting. After several cathartic drafts, he now worked on version number 5, with the older versions lay crumpled in the trash can. He reminded himself to burn them later because, for all he knew, Alex went through his stuff whenever he left the house. Somewhere around draft number 3, he came to the realization that everything Alex had become, Brian helped design, directly or indirectly. He introduced the kid to alcohol, and to drugs, and to all the lifestyle that went along with it. Brian had even introduced him to seductress Heather. When Alex saw Brian meeting people and selling them bags of weed, what else could he have learned from that? This epiphany filled Brian with such palpable guilt that he nearly forgot his grief for Heather. Version 5 of the letter that he had reframed into an apology began with a recounting of how Brian perceived Alex when they first met, impressionable, curious, and eager to learn. Then he described how Alex appeared now, selfish, self-destructive, and cruel. Brian admitted his own role in everything that happened and offered to help Alex get off the drugs. He even offered to quit doing everything with him, including the alcohol. The letter became his version of an intervention, and he hoped that Alex would take it to heart. Brian closed the letter, went out to the living room, and edged it under Alex's door. And that is your reading for the week. That is part 4, chapter 2, the Brian chapter, the Brian's sequel, basically, to the scene of him finding out about Heather. And in terms of scene sequel, I think this is good. There's a lot that's wrong with this chapter, obviously. But as a sequel to the scene of Brian finding out the truth about Megan and Heather, I think that it accomplishes what a sequel should accomplish, in that it gives Brian a chance to reflect on things that have happened. And what's missing from the scene sequel format here is that, you know, sequel comes in, there's little subparts of the sequel. And it goes like this. In a scene, something happens. And then in a sequel, you have the reaction to it. Then you have the character's dilemma about what to do next. And then you have a decision. And that decision leads you into the next scene where the character does something. So we have the reaction down pat in this chapter. There isn't a whole lot of dilemma here, and there isn't a decision. But, you know, for as far as my capabilities as a writer at the time that I wrote this, I think this is okay. Because at least we get a break from the action to get inside Brian's head and to feel what he's feeling. I think finally, after about 250 pages of the book, Brian is finally starting to seem like a bit of a sympathetic character, because so much bad has happened to him. And we can see how much he feels about all this. You know, we know Brian is kind of a sensitive guy. So we're getting inside his head pretty good. Even though in this chapter is some of the most distant point of view that's been in the entire book so far. Words like he considered the activity a form of self-flagellation. That's terrible. It's such distant POV. It's like we're reading an instruction manual about something that happened instead of actually feeling like we're inside of Brian's head. It's definitely a missed opportunity to give the reader some really close perspective on what Brian's going through. Also, about halfway through, I don't know if you spotted it during the reading. If you did, you were really paying attention, and good for you. There is a pretty significant plot hole that comes from over-editing, and I'll talk about that when I get back to it. But so this chapter basically falls in two scenes. Brian by himself scanning photographs. That's the motion that he's doing. And I know I talked about motion a couple weeks ago, adding motion to your scenes. And it doesn't really, it's sort of a telling kind of motion, because we don't actually see him scanning photographs very much. He does linger on one picture of Heather, but there's no action beats of him taking a picture, putting it on the scanner, pressing the button, and the scanner going, you know, as it turns it into a digital photograph. If you remember, this part of the book takes place in the year 2003, when most people probably did not have digital cameras. So if I don't know if you were of age back in those days, but you actually did, you have to purchase a scanner and put your photographs down on it like you were copying a piece of paper and turn it into something digital. It was a real pain in the ass. Anyway, so part one of this chapter is Brian by himself, and then Alex comes home, and then there's a dialogue chapter where a dialogue scene where Brian tries to explain to Alex that Heather has died, and Alex doesn't give a fuck. He's like Honey Badger, he just doesn't give a shit. And the point of that, I think, is to demonstrate how far Alex has changed on the spectrum, that Alex now really doesn't give a shit about anybody but himself. He's way more interested in drugs, and he is completely turned away from being Brian's friend, because he doesn't even care that Brian is upset about Heather's death. And that, I think, you know, now that I think about it, a couple weeks ago, or maybe last week, when I mentioned that Heather died, I said I'm not really sure why Heather had to die. But when I look at it from this chapter, in this context, now it makes sense, because it gives a perfect demonstration of how Alex and Brian have both changed. Someone who they both know has passed away. Brian is heartbroken, and Alex doesn't care. So this external event gives them both a chance to react to it. So it's a good way of showing their personalities. Instead of just talking about how Alex doesn't care about anything and Brian still does care, we get to see the reactions, and so I actually like that. And Heather's death now does have a meaning for the story. Okay, let's get into the chapter, and we'll go through some things as we go along. At the beginning of this chapter, I'm attempting to be in medias res with he considered the activity a form of self-flagellation, but he did it anyway. So you're thinking, well, what is this activity? And then the next sentence we find out that he's working on a long procrastinated project. Some of the distant POV in this chapter really grates on my nerves. We get a reminder about Heather. It doesn't say that she died just yet, but it's only been maybe 10 pages since we've seen Brian. So we don't really need a huge amount of recap, and the recap does come throughout the chapter. And so we know that Brian's been able to work on this project of converting pictures because Alex has been gone. And let me say this about that. So one thing that I like about this chapter is that if I were to publish this book, so we don't know where Alex has been this whole time. When Alex appears again, he doesn't say. You know, he just says that he just walks in with a duffel bag. He just says that he had to take care of some business. Now, if The Problematic Virtue were a book that I was selling, that Alex's disappearance for those several days would give me a great opportunity to write either a short story or a novella about where Alex had been during that time, and to either publish that as a side project, maybe give it away as a mailing list freebie, or give it away on my website, you know, something like give it away in exchange for people leaving reviews on Amazon for The Problematic Virtue. That was a great incentive for people to go leave reviews. Now, you can't tell them to leave you a 5-star review in exchange for it, because that's deceitful and dishonest and against Amazon's terms of service. But you can say, hey, you know, leave me a review on The Problematic Virtue and I'll send you the short story, or you could just give it away as a mailing list sign up. And then that gives you a great way. You can put that in the back, you know, the back matter of The Problematic Virtue. Say, hey, did you like this story? And you want to find out where Alex was in the week in between when Brian last saw him. And I'm saying all this because I did this with one of my novels that I did publish. And Reagan's Ashes, there's a period in the book where where one character becomes separated from two other characters for a period of 24 hours. And I didn't plan this out as I was writing it. It just, the story veered and followed this character for a while before that character reunited with the other two. And then later on, you know, people were telling me that I should write a sequel to Reagan's Ashes. And I was like, no, I don't really want to do that because I feel like the story is complete. But I saw this area where, you know, we don't know where Dalton and Charlie are for 24 hours, so I could fill in the blanks here about what happened to them during that time frame. So I wrote a short story. I was for a while giving it away as a freebie on my mailing list, but I think that in the spring of 2016, I'm actually going to put it on Amazon for sale for just a dollar. It's like a 40-page short story. So thinking of those kinds of extras and tie-ins and that kind of thing, those are good things. You may not be able to plan those from the beginning, but if you can, you know, these kind of tie-ins and side stories or prequel novellas, that kind of thing, readers love that shit. So anytime you can include that, you know, it's like DVD extras, but useful because people are going to actually want to consume it. So anyway, back to this reading. So we know, we get some summary of what's been going on. Brian spent nearly all of his time at home numbing his grief with beer and scanning pictures. So we know that Brian has been hanging out, just getting drunk, you know, because he's full of pain. So we know that Brian is in a really shitty place right now. He's scanned 200 pictures, and we know that he's been doing this for several days because he hasn't. I think it says it's several days. Alex has been gone for several days and left Brian with free reign of the apartment. So then we get actually the kind of tear-jerking moment where Brian looks at a picture of Heather. And I'm almost positive that I stole this from a movie. I can't remember which one, but this seems exactly like the kind of thing that would be in a movie. You know, Brian's heartbroken. He wants to forget about Heather, but he can't help wallowing in the grief of it. So he finds a picture of her wearing Brian's t-shirt. She's drinking a cup of coffee. This is a very, like, a Hallmark card kind of moment. You know, she's got the steaming coffee up over her face. She's wearing one of Brian's t-shirts on the balcony, and she's got a wry smile. It's like, how much more picturesque could it be? And this is probably the most painful thing that Brian could possibly see at this moment. And then right after he looks at the picture, we get some kind of summary about that. And I want to read this whole paragraph because As I'm reading this, tell me if you can spot the sin in this paragraph. Her pictures were the hardest to tolerate because he had none from the ugly and painful ending to their relationship. Scenes like the one of her wearing his t-shirt falsely emphasized the good times over the bad. He had no photos of her attempting to stop a nosebleed in the bathroom, arguing with him about something trivial, or having sex with his young, impressionable best friend. Without that kind of evidence, he could loiter in the euphoric recall. So, aside from the distant POV, the main sin in that paragraph is that it's so overwritten. Every sentence basically restates what the last sentence said. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4 four sentences, and each one says the same thing. You could probably get away with, if you cut the paragraph down to, her pictures were the hardest to tolerate because he had none from the ugly and painful ending of the relationship. He had no photos of her attempting to stop a nosebleed in the bathroom, arguing about him with something trivial, or having sex with his young, impressionable best friend. And so if you left in the first and the third sentence and cut out the second and the fourth, that would still work because the first sentence, her pictures were the hardest to tolerate, kind of sets it up, and then the second sentence about stopping a nosebleed, having sex with his young, impressionable best friend, those are examples of how he doesn't have pictures of the ugly and painful. But saying the sentence that says, without that kind of evidence, he could loiter in the euphoric recall, it's overwriting, it's not trusting the reader to understand, and it's just words that don't need to be there and could have been cut. So we get some information here about his phone's been ringing, and he hasn't answered it, so we know he still hasn't talked to Megan. That's the main point of that. And then there's also a mention here of his parents still looking for Jimmy, so we still don't know where Jimmy is, but his parents thought they'd find him when they turned up at an Idaho homeless shelter. And this is the kind of thing I probably would have inserted later because I've been like, you know, we need reminders that Jimmy's gone and also that his parents are still looking for him. But Brian doesn't really care. Not doesn't care, that's not the right word. Brian has let it go. He knows that Jimmy isn't coming back. And then the topic shifts to how he needs to talk to Wiles. So this first scene of this chapter is basically a whole lot of reminders of everything in Brian's story, and that's essentially okay. It all works in the context of the sequel. So, but he knows that he wants to stop selling drugs completely for Wiles, but he just doesn't know how to talk to Wiles about it because he's scared of him. And then we get this inner monologue that he'll just show up, and then a key turns in the lock. So it's supposed to make the reader think that it is Wiles, and it probably would have been more exciting if it was Wiles. But this next part of the chapter, this next scene with Alex coming in, I think is pretty good. It works pretty well. Take a drink. If you don't know what that joke means, listen to last week's show. So Alex comes in. He looks haggard. Brian doesn't know where he's been, and Alex doesn't say. I don't think later on in the book that where Alex has been is revealed. If it is, it's maybe just a sentence or two. There's no flashback scene to it or anything like that. So Alex looks haggard, and Brian also looks haggard. And Alex is just like, I had some business to take care of. And then there's conversation about the electric bill, just kind of normal roommate stuff. And the purpose of bringing that up is not only that it's normal roommate stuff, but so that Alex can be like, Alex can look like the big roller and say, you know, here, why don't you take care of the electric bill? And he just pulls out a bunch of money and throws it around the room like he's making it rain in the strip club. You know, he's got rows of 20s and a row of 30 or 40 bills. So that's a significant amount of money. And he's saying, I need to go out of town again. You know, here, you take care of this. So now Brian knows that he's going to have to tell Alex about Heather. His heartbeat quickens. His palms begin to sweat. He's going to have to talk about Heather, and that's going to make it real. This is the kind of thing that I think actually works to make Brian seem sympathetic. The fact that we see him being disturbed about Heather, and you know, and that the fact that he's going to have to share about it will make it real. So he tells Alex he needs to talk to him. Alex clearly doesn't take it seriously. Alex sits down, and his focus is instead on examining the quality of the pot he has in his bag, where he says shake. Shake is a weed term. I'm not going to go into it. Anyway, so he starts smoking the weed, and he's like, all right, let's hear it. And so as Brian's trying to tell him about Heather, Alex doesn't give a fuck. And he's like, you know, hey, this is important. Brian, you know, Alex even tries to turn on the TV. That's how few fucks he gives about all this. And so when Brian says Heather's gone, Alex is like, who? And here's when I talked before about the plot hole that I don't know if you spotted or not. When Brian says, Heather Robson, my ex, she was drunk and overdosed on cocaine. She died in the bathroom of a bar in Denver. And Alex says, hey, that's where I spent my 20th birthday. But if you noticed, Brian doesn't say which bar in Denver. But Alex says, that's where I spent my 20th birthday. Because in an earlier draft, Brian names the bar. And so Alex is like, hey, I know that bar. But apparently I took it out for some reason. I don't know why I took it out. Maybe I just wanted to name fewer places. But I didn't fix the line where Alex said that's where he spent his birthday. That's the kind of thing that an editor or beta readers would catch. So their conversation degrades. Alex clearly doesn't give a fuck about Heather. And we see Brian. And there is actually a couple sentences here where we get some actual good POV. Because after Alex says, I don't think I'll make it, you have a good time. In the text, it just says, unbelievable. This level of indifference was outrageous, even for Alex. That is real inside Brian's head kind of POV. And then we see Brian start to get upset. What the hell's wrong with you, Heather? You remember my ex-girlfriend, the one that you fucked. Now, the word fuck appears a lot in this book. Alex likes to say it. Wiles really likes to say it. Brian, though, Brian doesn't swear very much. Hardly at all. And that's the thing that I usually... I use profanity as a tool in my books, and I know it offends some people, but fuck it, whatever. I think it's dumb to be offended by profanity. And if you're listening to the show, you're probably not offended by profanity because you know I say fuck a lot. I think it's a good tool you can use. It helps determine... I'm pretty sure I've talked about this before. It helps determine a lot of things about a character. And so Brian is the kind of person who doesn't swear very much. So my intention with him saying, my ex-girlfriend, the one that you fucked, is to demonstrate how upset Brian is about this. I don't know if it works or not, because I don't know if Brian has a serious enough or well-made enough dialogue pattern that a reader would notice him using a word that he doesn't normally use. So anyway, Brian is upset. Alex is going back to his standard answer about how things are black and white. You know, he's saying this is just life. Tide comes in, tide goes out. And Brian starts to get upset. He calls him a selfish piece of shit, and this seems entirely normal. But anyway, Alex doesn't care, and Alex leaves. So Brian goes to write him a letter. And so the last couple of paragraphs, the last page of this chapter, is Brian writing a letter. He writes several drafts. And he eventually, you know, gets to a draft that he feels like he can share with Alex. And Brian also has a realization that he introduced Alex to drugs. And so that part of, he thinks at least, that part of how Alex is Brian's fault. And it says, this epiphany filled Brian with such palpable guilt that he nearly forgot his grief for Heather. The POV is distant, but the intent of that line is still pretty good. And then, so the chapter ends with Brian going to, you know, Brian's got a plan. He says, you know, I'm going to help you get off drugs. He's writing all this in the letter. He says he'll even quit with him. And then the chapter ends with Brian sliding the letter under Alex's door. And as far as the ending of this chapter goes, there's not really anything exciting about that. Other than Brian has a plan. Well, you know, before when I talked about the scene sequel thing and I said how there was no decision, no plan... That's actually not true now. There's no dilemma and decision when it comes to what to do about Heather or Megan. But there is the dilemma and decision about what to do about Alex. So in the second half of this chapter, when Brian interacts with Alex, we do actually get some sequel, you know, reaction to Brian now finally sees how terrible Alex is, and his reaction to it is, this is partly my fault. So his dilemma is, what am I going to do about this? And then his decision is, he wants to help Alex get off drugs. So, and I do know that in part of the, you know, for the rest of the book, this is one of Brian's main goals. is that he is going to try to help Alex get away from this. This kind of thing has been sort of hinted at before, you know, that Brian followed Alex to see what kind of trouble he was getting in. Brian worried about him, but Brian hasn't ever really had a plan to do anything until now. He had his sort of idea, you know, that he would sell drugs for Wiles and Wiles would in turn keep Alex out of trouble. But that really wasn't much of a plan because it didn't really go anywhere. It didn't progress. It just sort of got forgotten. So now Brian actually has a plan and he's going to take some action. And whatever action he takes about that, we're going to have to wait until future episodes because I'm done talking about this one. And so that's all I have to say for this week. Thank you everyone for listening. Thanks for putting up with all the ins and outs of the Indie Author Answers. And I will see you guys next week. Bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste. So please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers. And you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it. Thank you.